See, here's the basic trend in the fiber field in those days. The higher cost of agricultural products, which means cotton and viscose and
rayon,
the higher cost of agricultural products, increasing industrial productivity and growing population are the fundamental pressures behind industry's drive for newer and better synthetics. Today, Americans want more clothes. They can afford better clothes, and there are an ever-increasing number of Americans to order them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was basically that. And we went into the wool-like fiber. Now the nylon was a silk-like fiber, you see.
Yeah. And DuPont had that wrapped up.
And they had that wrapped up, and they gave us a license to one of the patents, and we got into it. Mm-hmm. And after we had an operating company called Chemistran producing ethylene, of which I was president of Chemistran.
Could we talk a little bit about Chemistran then? I gathered from the production in Alabama didn't begin until 52, I think, if I recall.
Yeah, so, about that. I think that's about.
So you were president during a startup phase when there was still development work going on.
See, we did the development work in Dayton, but we had the plant in Decatur, Alabama, and of course we got that plant started.
Why Decatur, Alabama?
I don't remember.
Perhaps it was because that's where the you didn't make cloth, you just made fiber.
We just made the fiber.
Yeah, so perhaps that's where the clothing manufacturers were, the textile manufacturers.
I don't recall that. I mean, it was close to Anniston, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
We had a plant there, but...
Did Viscose have something to say about where it was?
No.
Yeah.
Well, Viscose had a plant there. Well, they were in it, of course. We were 50-50 partners in Anniston.
Yeah.
And they made me president of it during this, you might say, the research development phase.
There must have been different kinds of problems in developing a new fiber than there were in some of the hydrocarbons and, you know, sort of petrochemical-based research. Yeah. I wonder if you could talk about some of those challenges.
What do you mean, how they did?
Well, they were, many of the problems must have been engineering problems. In spinning
the
fiber.
Or in the construction of the plant, sometimes in the production of the product. So the nitrile was engineering. So what? And then the plant itself, well, we had to make the polymer for the fiber. And that required engineering, of course. It was done for the polymerization process for acrylic nitrile. And special conditions, and then in the fiber itself. And spinning the fiber, that was another engineering problem, how to wash out the solvent and so on. But the spinnerets, you see, would give off a little fiber, and then that would be wound up, and we had to wash, and in that process, we had to wash out any solvent that might have been remaining in it, and come up with a spool of fiber. Such as this, although this is nylon, but this is an example of what I mean. That's nylon.
Yeah. It didn't have the lighter attached to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But each Bob had its own specific problems which we had to meet and try to solve.
If I could ask a slightly different question about Chemstrand, that period in the late 40s is when polymer science was really coming into its own after a lot of the work that had been done.
We had a plastics plant at Springfield, Massachusetts. And at first we made the polymer for Aqualand at that plant.
Mm-hmm.
Then we transferred it later, we put in another plant to make the polymer right where we were doing the spinning.
Mm-hmm. Were you and your other chemists and chemical engineers following the work that was going on in polymer science in general? You know, and Carruthers' work and a lot of the work on mechanisms that had been done in World War II?
God helping us, they did.
Were the staff going to things like the Gibson Island conferences on polymers and the usual ACS meetings and
presenting papers sometimes? Well, we had an alert crowd. I mean, the incentive was there. They looked at it. Not that I'm saying that they were the best people in the world, but they were damn good people.
After you came back from being president of Chemstrand, you just returned full time to being vice president of research, development, and
in charge of the
and engineering
operation all over the country.
We started to talk briefly at lunch about the difference in managing 80 people and the difference in managing a few thousand people, which is
I don't see any difference.
Well, I just wondered if you could
put it on a larger scale, that's all.
Could you just talk a little bit about the differences in running Thomas and Hochwald laboratories in the 30s and being in charge of all technology and science for a very large corporate organization?
Well, it just meant that I was busier and I had to have more contacts with the directors of research, associate directors, and so on, before I would do it more or less personally with the individuals, you see. But I had to let others do that, and then they in turn reported to me, you see. So that's, you might say, my authority was extended to the associate directors, group leaders, and directors of research.
Did you find, did you miss the laboratory?
Yes, I did. I stopped doing laboratory work in, when was it, 40 or 45. I missed that.
You were dealing more with budgets than chemicals?
I was dealing with projects as they were going on, but I didn't have, there were so many of them, I didn't have any time to spend on it, except in a supervisory capacity. To these other people, my assistants, if you want to call them. So it's an extension of your authority through other people.
How did Monsanto go about planning long-term developments in this larger arena? I mean, at Thomas and Hochwald, clients would come in with a problem, or you would seek out a client if you had an answer to their problem. But it must have been slightly different trying to plan where the company should be 10 years down the road across a broad front like that.
To me, that was more or less obvious in what was going on. If you keep up with the industry and with the literature and so on, you don't have any trouble doing that. But how do you know when synthetic detergents were coming in? You knew when textile fibers were coming in, and the clock was successful. They showed a clear path. And the petroleum and the petrochemicals, I mean, you needed certain raw materials for plastics, you needed for detergents. And that enabled you to carry on in petrochemicals to produce those. So one follows the other. To me, that's a simple matter.
So, how did you keep up with things? Just, personally, did you continue to read the chemical literature, or you just...
Some friends, I used to study patterns sometimes when passengers would come in. And that's where I saw that the Russians had, through the use of a reduction process, caused the dimerization of the acrylonitrile. Well, that's as far as it went. But I could see that that's a damn good raw material for the raw materials needed for nylon. So I called up on the phone one day and told our director of research, for Christ's sake, put somebody on this job on the dimerization, electro-dimerization of acrylonitrile and see what you can do. Fortunately, he had an awfully good man that he put onto it. And within a year, by God, we were making raw materials of nylon from acrylonitrile, which made one main product of Monsanto useful for two different fibers that we were in.
Sure. So had you been
the natural?
Yeah. Were you buying the nylon intermediates outside before that?
Well, we were making them too by the standard methods. But this is a much cheaper, you just put this into an electrolyzed acrylonitrile. And that causes two of them to join together, acrylonitrile, which gives you a C6 chain. Then you take that and you can make adipic acid, which is one of the raw materials, or you can take adipic acid and hydrogenate, or hydrolyze it. And make
ethylene diamond. Yeah, well, that was sick. And again, there's
that's just one example. Yeah. I mean, this is my own going through the literature and telling the inventor. I mean, my name is not on that patent. It's the man who did the work, Basil. But I had the idea, I might say, of the utilization of one raw material for two fibers. Manny Basic. He's now retired from Montana. That's about the extent of it, isn't it? 20 minutes to 3.
Yeah, would you like to stop there and we can...
You think we got enough?
Well, we... I mean, there's
certain audio points.
Oh, most of them, yeah. We could talk... At some time, we could talk a little bit more about some of the work that you did after you retired from Monsanto. I'd be interested in...
After leaving Monsanto?
Yeah,
I'd rather not talk about that. Don't respond to the specific findings.
The one thing that just struck me about it was you started off in consulting and then came full circle back to consulting.
Ended up in that. Well, what the hell? I didn't want to sit on my rear end and do that. And I'm still interested in things, and I keep up fairly well with what's going on. So that when these companies came in, and I had, I don't know how many, I had 6 or 7 companies in that period, from 64 until now. I haven't got any now, but because I gave them up. But I had, well, I told you this morning, Cut the Light, Telegraph, Whitco, English Company, Monta Edison in Italy, so on. I used to do a lot of traveling.
Well, you'd have to with clients that widely distributed. Well, that's... I think that we have covered most things, and
I think so.
Yeah, I just had one other thing that we usually ask at the end of an interview is, you must have accumulated in addition to the materials you showed us. Do you have other papers and files that you've accumulated over the years, or?
Hell, I got a scrapbook. I mean, it is actually scrap. Anything in that. I looked over some of the things, and that's the principal thing. And of course, that's the time I left Monsanto, those books.
Does Monsanto have records from your years there? Did they keep files, your office files in there?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what. I think so, though. In that article that they interviewed me on, which I gave you, I mean, you might read that, and that'll bring you up to date.
Yeah, I'll look forward to reading that. I would like to read that.
But this other scrapbook is, well, it's just scrap in its almost horrible sense. But I was just going through this, some accumulations of junk. Some of it's repetitious, too. And that's that article I gave you. And you have this. It's the original building of that site. Mm-hmm. That's what we bought when we found moving from this other place in town. And this is just pictures of the upper laboratory. Yeah, this is, we moved from this laboratory here.
Oh, yeah.
On the third floor up there.
Must have gotten a little warm there in the summer. It must have gotten warm in the summers on the third floor.
Yeah. Well, this is just a little pamphlet. This is just, I don't know, you had that. And
that's right, yeah.
And also I gave you this, the bomb on that newspaper, mm-hmm. the date and work. They come with an awful laboratory, and I continue the landscape.
Well, those I could, I'd just like to take a reference. I think we have that journal in the library.
Well, you can take that if you want.
Okay.
And it is a talk I gave before the University of Missouri as well. You have this.
Yes, I will put that with me.
Well, these are just newspaper articles, right? Maybe I talk too much in my day. But people were asking me, and this is the eyewitness account of the bikini test.
Yeah, that we would be interested in.
That's in that newspaper article, too, but I think maybe you'd better use that.
Yeah.
But for two sick returns.
Oh, of course.
I mean, things like this. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the newspaper. I don't think it's worthwhile. I thought the lead drive over to the University of Dayton. After 50 years to be after and the little fight with the city. You don't want that.
Well, perhaps we can sit down at some other time and talk about your work on regional development with the St. Louis Research Council and some other things. That's
this is when I got my degree at St. Louis U, honorary degree. I had luck doing the city one, and I don't think this is of any importance to it.
Okay. Well, this looks as though it might be from the bikini test.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the diary. Mm-hmm.
Right
here, well, that's a local situation.
Mm-hmm.
just cutting the side of the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Development that was not successful, so we better not talk about it.
It was
brilliant.
Yeah, I had that on my list. I didn't know if you wanted to talk about it or not.
We talk about failures and you got some success.
Well, wasn't the problem really that it was word got out too soon? And
no, it took too much to get it into the soil. Because you have to put it into the soil so that it will start agglomerating and form the polyelectrolytic action that's required. And it took too much labor to get it in there.
Mm-hmm. So it was, the chemistry was fine, it was just
chemistry the chemistry was fine, yeah. You know. There's a chemist in the lab until I have some more pictures of our research group.
Most of those are probably in the other scrapbook, I guess.
Yeah.
The older ones.
That's about it.
Yeah. Well, that's, these we would like to borrow. We'll certainly be all but thank you. I wonder if we could end with just a few words on the on your work that you were telling us about at lunch, the atomic, the work on the Manhattan Project and the bikini test, which was after the war, but. Would you like to say a few words about that on tape?
Well, there's really not much to say except that I attended the meetings with the other people, GE and Westinghouse people, and we were, of course, the favorite boys out there. We flew from Washington to California, and boarded government planes, went to Hawaii, and then in Hawaii we were picked up by a gunboat,
mm-hmm.
And Hawaii. So we flew out to Kwajalein from Hawaii. There we got on the destroyer,
mm-hmm.
And we got there the next day at Katina, where we on ships, of course, we lived on a ship, not this naval vessel, but a passenger ship,
mm-hmm.
In order to watch the shots, and then afterwards, after it's over, we inspected the ships. After the radioactivity died down a little, found that even cans of fruit and so on were radioactive as a result of the fruit and so on in the can.
Mm.
And of course it destroyed this Japanese ship, this battleship, Nagato, I believe it was. And it was just a marvelous experience to see that.
Yeah. What did you and the rest of the group talk about? I mean, do you remember anything in particular that people talked about afterwards while you were on the way back?
Just the effectiveness and the awfulness of the bomb. That's about all.
Yeah.
Except there was no terror. I mean, to see that damn thing go off with these immense clouds of what my article described.
Yeah, well, we'll certainly be able to read that.
You see these enormous clouds of smoke going to the heavens, and different flashes of light. And it was a scary thing, I can tell you that. But nevertheless, I feel the way I said at lunch. So, so far as we're concerned, by God, we better keep the bomb and keep it alive.
Yeah, as a deterrent.
As a deterrent.
Yeah. Well, that's just two other questions. One is, what have we left out something that you really wanted to tell us about? Is there anything else that I should have asked you but didn't?
You've been pretty effective about it. One thing I can tell you is it's a great life, and if I had to do it over again, I'd do the same. Take up chemistry, and because I still think any opportunities today, I think they're just as great as they were when I came out of school. Just that you have to be maybe a little bit smarter and at least be aware of what's going on and what is needed and what's going on.
Yeah.
That's the important thing, you know, what people need. I mean, if they're going into the chemical industry, now are we going to have plastic automobiles and so on? Yes, I think to some extent we will. I think we need it because I think it would be less expensive if we can get these polymers to have the high strength and endurance that they should have, and many of them have not. And so I think the opportunity for the youngster who wants to go into chemistry is still great, in my opinion.
Well, that's,
everything hadn't been done.
Well, those words may be as inspirational for some youngster who reads this as the discussions you had with your professor were.
One thing I know is that it follows out my life. You know, even into a happy life. I mean, as I was trying to describe, it's full of discovery. There's just nothing like it. And I've been through that many times. Seeing something, feeling something, tasting something, smelling something that no one has ever seen or heard of before.
Yeah. Which, of all the things you were talking with us about today, which do you think is the one discovery that really thrilled you the most? Or is it too good?
Well, the alkaline was one of them. Some of the detergents and the agricultural chemicals, although I had nothing to do with that. I mean, I was instrumental in Monsanto getting into it. But Howard Mason and the research group, the organic division, did it. But I used to follow it rather closely. And so that you get more food, more growth per acre, more feed per animal. And, I mean, it takes less feed per animal in order to produce a pound of meat. That sort of thing. I think that's where the movement is going to be, continue to be, and that's even biotechnology is becoming so important. And maybe we can raise plants that in themselves will be resistant to to bugs, pesticides. I mean, to the animal world. And that's through biotechnological methods.
Well, it is an exciting prospect. Well, that may be a good note on which to close. And I'd just like to thank you for taking the time to.
I enjoyed it very much.
We've enjoyed learning more about your career.
I hope I didn't bore you.
No, far from it. It was very, very interesting and illuminating. I'd just like to thank you again.
Well, happy to do it.
pleasure of being able to talk with Monty Throder also. That worked out well.
Oh, you called him before you came and said you were going to be there.
Yes.
I don't think Monty's done anything. Oh. I don't think so.
He's retired from the company.
That's what I mean.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. He's,
I don't think... See, I carried on after I retired. I went, I took on a lot of companies again. Consulting. I'm doing very little of it now. But I had a lot of companies.
Have we got the other tape then, Jeff?
Yes, we do.
We can go again. Before the tape started, you talked about how the Monsanto connection developed. But I wonder if you'd just go over that again, Dr. Hopwell, so that we've got it on the tape.
Well, as I say, we had contact with Monsanto through being customers of theirs. With the chlorosulfonic acid, the phenyl chloride, and the chlorobenzene for the carbon remover. And they had a man by the name of Watt, W-A-T-T. We used to, he was in the development end, I guess, and he maintained these contacts with us because we were customers, you see. And so then, as a result of that, Monsanto gave us some contacts. We worked on for the phosphorus group. And we worked on detergents. Well, really, the principal things going into the detergents. And they were working with polymers, styrene, styrene butadiene, acrylonitrile, general chemicals. And they gave us a contract, but particularly to be acquainted with the general chemical field to help them in that. It was, but then when we were taken into the company, they bought us. Then we went into detergents, got them into ag chemicals. Synthetic fibers, of course. As we sold that to the board, because I was on the board too, and Charlie also, Monsanto, after, I think it was in 47 I went on the board. We developed the sodium tripolyphosphate at the builder for detergents, and also the detergent, put them in the general chemicals we used to watch, plasticizers and oil additives and new methods for making nylon intermediates, which is the point on that was I wanted, this is a pet of mine, we used acrylonitrile for the raw material for our alkaline in Monsanto. I wanted to use it also to make nylon intermediates, and was successful in doing that through the hydrodimerization of acrylonitrile to make adipic and then hexamethylene diamine. And Monsanto is using that today. These were new processes for the intermediates without going to the standard products, the butadiene and so on.
Let me take you back into the Lynn Watt and the development of the Monsanto connection.
Yeah.
Was he very much the key player in that period when Monsanto work was being funneled to the lab?
Yes, he was. He was a friend of ours and was a good employee at Monsanto. And he had the contact, and then
I think what intrigued them and intrigued Edgar Queenie was the fact that we were buying chemicals from them, and my God, the sales weren't very high. Chlorophenic acid, for instance. Who in the hell would use that except a crazy nuts like that? And metal chloride, of course, that was a big volume. We made carbon remover for the Alamite Corporation. Our laboratory did, Thomas and Hawthorne. We developed that patent a bit, sold it to Alamite, and we made it and put it up in cans and so on. This is to remove carbon from automotive engines.
Yeah.
And became automatic. Chrysler started using it as an automatic when you stopped your motor at night to drive, to put it in the drive. You'd pull it on the last pull and it would suck the can contents into the motor, you see. Let it stand overnight. Next morning, start up the motor and blow all the damn carbon out. Now, this is before ethyl became prevalent, you see. I was interested from that angle, and then seeing our record on that, why, then they started giving us a lot of that work. They said we'd call phosphate, tritium, sodium tripolyphosphate, phosphate. Builder and synthetic detergents. We did that while we were still consulting with them.
Yeah.
And we developed the baking powder from calcium phosphate oil. That was our principal work. I mean, we went to Monsanto and when we came into the company, then we opened up. And the reason Edgar really bought us out, he wanted to better the character of Monsanto's scientific reputation, because at that time it was not any really interesting new things. I mean, the standard products and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think he wanted to better that, and he thought maybe acquiring us would help.
When did you first meet him, Edgar Queenie?
Well, I don't know, sometime during those intervening years. They bought us in 37. Well, it's between 30 and 37, that's about all I can, I can say.
Was the idea of the Monsanto purchase something that came quite suddenly, or had it been discussed for a number of years before it?
No, it came quite suddenly. He came in and put it that way. He said, as I said before, you get so damn expensive, you're cheaper to buy it out. And he was a very pleasant, great guy. But that's the way he put it. And so then negotiations started, which only lasted a month or so, and it concluded in Easter. Easter Day in 1936.
He was, from what you just told us, he said obviously a large fraction of Monsanto's outside research budget was going to Thomas and Hochwald Laboratories. How much of your practice was Monsanto at that time?
In our laboratory,
yeah.
I would say about 30%.
And were part of the negotiations what you were going to have to do with other clients at that time?
We had to give them up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went around and explained it to our various clients.
Yes, we had to get them all up. Monsanto was number one.
About how many clients did you have by that time?
We had about 11,
mm-hmm.
including Monsanto.
Didn't the prospect of going back inside the corporation cause you some qualms? You said earlier you'd wanted to be...
Back inside?
Well, you'd wanted to be independent. And Thomas
Hoffman
had been a very independent.
Well, we were pretty independent. With Monsanto, I mean, I was in Dayton. Well, both of us were originally. Charlie didn't move over to St. Louis in 45, and I moved here in 49. But we were pretty independent, by God, and we wanted to do something. Of course, we had to get the approval of the board of the executive committee. But that wasn't a problem by that time. By 1947, we were both on the executive committee and on the board. Charlie was in 45, as a matter of fact. I went on in 47, I think it is. That's in my bibliography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we wanted something done, then we went to Edgar. Edgar was a very well-minded and ambitious for the company, and as I see, I think he wanted to better the stature, the scientific stature of the company. So he would listen to us. He would listen to these things. I mean, selling in Monsanto to go into synthetic fibers. Well, I presented the problem to them, and presented the statistics and all that, and it was just like that. God gives, go ahead. And things like that, I mean, but it was to take place in any atmosphere you see anything was going on. I mean, Edgar and I used to go fishing a lot up in Newfoundland. He transacted a lot of business up there and a lot of new things to do.
When was that? That was in the late 30s and...
That was in those days. No, that was in the 40s.
Yes.
40 and then in the 50s. But Edgar and I traveled around Europe too. We meet all the chemical people in Europe, the German outfits and so on. See, I was looking for new things, I mean, trying to broaden my channel in all respects. And so I was sort of the contact man with a lot of companies, you see. And I had friends all over Germany and France and Italy. And that's when we bought the Italian company, C. Edison. Which then became Monsanto Edison, which is the largest chemical company in Italy today. But Edgar was a very misunderstood person. They thought he was hard-boiled and insensitive to people. He was quite the opposite. He was very sensitive to people and things.
So there wasn't any dramatic shift in your
loss of independence, if that's what you want to put it there. Except we did have to get the approval, yes, I mean, of a board.
Yeah.
But that was so simple.
How long did it take in the late 30s to get from Dayton to St. Louis?
To St. Louis? By train, it took about 8 hours.
So it was a sort of two. If you went, did you go to St. Louis very much in that initial period, or
not too much? They would be more here in Dayton.
Mm-hmm.
Although I used to get over there, like
that was in And a man by the name of Gaston Dubois, who was with Monsanto, and he was really in the position which I took later in charge of all the technology and all that. He used to keep in fairly close contact with us. We had meetings with him regularly. We would get up to date on what we were doing.
Could you tell us a little bit about what Monsanto was like when you and Charlie Thomas first began to work exclusively on new technology for Monsanto? I mean, what?
I mean, this is after the merger.
Yeah, about late 1930s. What was the company like? What were the major products? What were some of the major challenges that Queenie and the others explained to you as you began to consider?
Well, they didn't explain to us. We explained to Well, we knew we had to go into synthetic detergents, and we put an end to that. We knew we had to go into fibers, synthetic fibers, and we were fortunate in that we developed an Acrolam, had a plant and operating at DuPont approaches, because they were being looked at with a little bit of questioning by the trust department, antitrust. And they looked around for a company to whom to license under their nylon patents in order to. Mm-hmm. And they selected us. Now, at that time, we had already joined with with Merck and Visco to form Chemistran Corporation, which I was the first president. And when that happened, then DuPont wanted us to take a license out in order to free them from this surveillance on the part of the trust department, which we did. So that's how we got into nylon. And incidentally, Charlie Thomas and Greenwald, who was the president of DuPont at that time, were good friends. That didn't hurt either.
Good friends from some previous background, or?
At school, I think, at MIT. Mm-hmm. And also, it was through Charlie had a very good friend, Hank DuPont, Henry DuPont, and that brought him closer to Greenwald, too. Hank DuPont was one of the DuPonts in the company.
One of the problems that faced a lot of chemical companies in the 30s and 40s was linking research to production and really, you know, making the transition from the laboratory to commercial introduction more efficient. And I, with your labs in Dayton, what kind of arrangements were there to keep in touch with Monsanto's manufacturing end as well? I mean, was that something that you had to work on?
We put the pilot plan in at Dayton. We had the pilot plane on styrene, and we put Monsanto on the styrene. At the time, another reserve was forming up, and Dow was in styrene too. But we beat Dow out and became with this pilot plane, and got a lot of rubber reserve business. Mm-hmm. But that put us also into styrene plastics, you see, having styrene monomer available. Sure. So we got into a plastic and using styrene with other things.
And would the staff at Dayton then, would people come from the manufacturing locations to work on the pilot plant with your staff and then farm it back?
But most of it was done in St. Louis, of course. I mean, because, they had more chemical engineers and more plant men, of course, to operate, and we didn't have that. We could only do it on a smaller scale. We had an acrylonitrile pilot plant in Dayton. We had the pilot plant on fibers and making of Acrolam in Dayton. Mm-hmm. That's because we initiated it, you see. But on other things and products, general chemicals and so on, they would do that in St. Louis, or their plants up at Merrimack and Boston. or the rubber chemicals at nitro.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go into that sort of thing. Does that answer your question?
Oh yeah, I was just trying to get at what you know, the transition from the basic work to.
But if we instituted the process in the laboratory, we usually went through the pilot plant on it ourselves.
Well, it was Dayton was busy in terms of pilot plants in the early 40s because you had styrene, you had some acrylonitrile work going on. You you were beginning, I think, to start work on the on all the low sudsing detergents, or was that a little bit later?
Yeah, no, all also. Well, that's an interesting thing. That was a special detergent. But to show how chemistry and that chemical industry can make this a better life, as Kettering did at the start with the motors for women, we did the same damn thing with all. At the time, it was thought that all. That in order to have good detergent, so you get cleansing action on fabric, you need a large volume of suds. This is P&G talking. And we came up with this product, which we eventually called All, which is ethylene oxide adductor. That was a marvelous detergent and did not foam. No suds at all. Well, one day, and it did happenstance, Westinghouse came to the laboratory. I think they heard about it somewhere. And they told us about their problem. They wanted to come out with this mechanical clothes washer. Says, we can't do it because the damn suds just flow right out of the machine all over the floor and so on. And it says, our machines are not good. And I said, oh, by God, we got your problem solved already. And I went back on the shelf back in the laboratory and gave him the product. I said, now this one will work. And it was All. But no suds in the damn machine, and that's the reason the mechanical dishwasher went over. Because they came up with a non-subject detergent. And we were responsible for that.
Yeah. Was it hard to get people to accept the fact that a no suds could still get something clean?
Well, you can have detergency tests and determine that without any difficulty very quickly. Yeah.
So there wasn't resistance to it, consumer resistance.
No. But that's what made Westinghouse, and that's when they came out with a mechanical washer. You know, a hell of a lot of this sounds boastful to me. I hope that that's.
Not a problem. Very impressive career of achievement.
Are you getting hungry?
Well, we should.
Let me see, it's 11:45.
Well,
would you like to go down to the club now and
sure,
just take a little recess?
And we could start up again after lunch.
Can you tolerate a little more after lunch? What's
Yeah, sure.
Let's take
a bathroom
there
if you want to use that.
Make sure this is working again.
Yeah.
That's fine. Okay. Well. Okay. I wondered if we might go back for a minute to the pre-Monsanto years. Before we started taping this morning, you were talking about some of the growth of your clientele in the growth of your clientele in the 20s and 30s, and I just wondered if we could go over a little bit more of that and then go back to to Montana.
Well, where in the hell is my list? Did I find that? Clients, you want the clients? Right?
Yes.
Okay, I got it.
And we discussed this morning the way in which General Motors had provided a subsidy for you for a couple of years, and you were doing work on polymerization of dienes for them, and along with Midgley. The firefighter work that you told us about was one of your early successes, and that was
helping. The first one.
And that was...
That's the first invention we had together.
Mm-hmm. And that was... the royalties from that were helping to support the lab as well. And then you began to look for other clients, presumably, or did you? You said some of them just came right to the door after the fortune had... how did the business...
You know, as a matter of fact, I don't know how we acquired companies. But I know we didn't have any trouble getting them.
That's a good position to be in.
You see, Standard of New Jersey, that they came in. We developed from a product made by carbide, which is a byproduct. It's a cracked product. They got from their cracking stills. And we took it and made a resin. There's a lot of unsaturated compounds in it, you see. And we would, with aluminum chloride, polymerize that and made resin, which we called Sanctu resin. And they were at one time interested in it and was going to buy it, but then they lost interest in it. And then Monsanto took it over. It's called Sanctu resin. And that's how Jersey came into the picture. General, do you want me to go into this?
Oh, sure.
General Motors, that was synthetic rubber. That was at their request, you see. But we were not successful in that, although we did determine a lot of the elements and chemistry, other things. And as a result of that, now that came later, I was going to say, as a result of that, we went into styrene, but we did not do that until we joined Monsanto.
Okay.
And because we were interested in that, so far as the raw material for synthetic rubber, for rubber reserve, and also for the product per se, to make new types of polymers. I think I went into that this time. Mini Paper Company, and that was a paper company in Chillicothe, Ohio, and we worked on sizing agents and so on for their paper, melamine types and so on.
I'm Arthur Little started off in in the same area in chemicals for the paper industry. I'm just I'm curious to know whether you stole that away from Little or
it away from him.
No. You did.
No. No. I never heard of it.
No. I'm just curious to know whether that was an area in which you did face competition from Arthur Little Inc.
No, we didn't even know what the hell Arthur D. Little was doing. I sat outside of a lot of testing work and just a testing laboratory, which we were not. Alton Weiberg Printing Company, Printing Inc., they were interested. There was an outfit down in Cincinnati, which is now part of a nice company. It's with a big company. But anyway, we were interested in developing new types of carbon papers for them. And also compositions of printing ink. National Distillers, we with them because of our work on making quick age whiskey.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. That was that sounded like an interesting story. Let me just flip the tape over.
That is Well, the way that came about
went to, as you remember, Roosevelt. When did he come in? 33?
That's right.
He went into office. Well, we anticipated his election, and that he would get in. And we secondly, we anticipated that he would throw prohibition out. And so we, about a year before then, or less than a year before that, we started thinking about whiskey and what to do about green whiskey, because it would take, you'd have to age it 4 years in the cask before you could sell it. And because it wasn't potable, and it took that long to remove the greenness by doing it in a cask. So we thought it was, that's a good project to work on, and have whiskey, since we knew it would be on the market, I mean, that he would throw prohibition out. And of course we were right in that. And we started working 6 or 8 months before that. And we tested green whiskey. Of course it has a horrible taste and flavor. Mm. Now this is a whiskey just as it comes off the still, you see, before any aging in a oaken cask is concerned. And the peculiar taste, I mean that horrible taste is due to congeners which form in the distillation and in the fermentation. And products like aldehydes and acids and so on, which have this awful taste and odor. We knew what those products were in green whiskey. We analyzed it and decided that the best thing to try in order to get rid of those was to hydrogenate it. So we took green whiskey and with a nickel catalyst, grainy catalyst made from aluminum and sodium, nickel and sodium, dissolve out the sodium and half the nickel there, that was the grainy catalyst, and put that in with the distilled spirits, heated it up, and that would hydrogenate these congeners, as they're called, these impurities, really, in green whiskey. And lo and behold, by God, it came out as perfectly tasteless alcohol. Mm. Took out that greenness completely. And oxidation would probably do it too, but hydrogenation was a simpler way of doing it. Mm. So we, after getting that result, we approached National Distillers to see if they might be interested in that and be ready for the market when it was open after Roosevelt threw out prohibition. And sure enough they were, and they asked us to continue work on it, and we developed a pilot plant which we placed in one of their distilleries in Louisville. Mm. Old Granddad Distillery it was. And sure enough, the product worked beautifully. And in order to make the finished saleable whiskey, I understand that it was pretty horrible still in taste. But nevertheless, it had alcohol in, and it would be available, you see. And it wasn't too bad, but at least the greenness wasn't there anyway. So we took that, and then we leached wood chips in order to give it a color and somewhat of a lignin taste, which bourbon whiskey has to have, and found that we made 3 million pints of whiskey. That's 3 million. Pints of whiskey for a distillery, National Distillers, which they had ready on the day that Roosevelt put it back in Carson so they could get into the market right away.
Well, that must have turned out to be very lucrative for them.
It was. Well, it was a timely thing, but it was our sense of this happening. Roosevelt acting the way he did, that he would be elected and he would remove that law. And as I say, we went to National Distilleries and they were very much interested in it, and we produced this whiskey in a pilot plant at the distillery. And we had about 3 million bottles that we made that they had ready for sale when the law was changed. And there was a lot of chemistry in this too. We determined what the congeners were and the amount in there before hydrogenation, after hydrogenation, and so on. And bettered the taste of it so that it was potable. Although certainly not a high grade bourbon whiskey.
Yeah. That was, I recall, an earlier patent that you had taken out on the problem of orange peel in lacquers that also involved hydrogenation, didn't it?
That was for Sharpless.
Yeah.
I'm a little hazy on that. But we hydrogenated some of the solvents that's used in the lacquers, you see. Here's a slowed up the drying. Of it to some extent.
Here's one of the papers you published on that. You know.
Dehydration. Yeah. The double dehydration process was the treatment. The nitrocellulose is a little boiling alcohol, followed by high boiling oil, and removes more water from the nitrocellulose, therefore reduces the orange peel. Slowly evaporating solvents in combination. That was the important point. Slowly evaporating solvents in combination, completely dehydrated nitrocellulose, reduce the orange peel to a negligible pH. Mm-hmm. Well, that tells the story.
Yeah. How did they get in touch with you? Do you remember?
Let me see. Well, Phil Sharpless is an old friend of ours. He's a friend of Charlie's and a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this is one of their main businesses, and I think through that friendship, we talked about it, and he asked us to work on it, and gave us a research contract on it.
Mm-hmm.
This struck you, huh?
When I was thinking when I read through a number of your early patents during those years and the papers was that, well, this one wasn't quite as clear as the case we were just talking about with the catalytic hydrogenation.
Yeah.
But it seemed to me that both you and Charles Thomas had familiarity with catalytic hydrogenation from your work at General Motors.
We did. I had a lot of experience on hydrogenation.
I did this through
the work I did with Kettering, you see, and changing benzoyl to cyclohexane,
which was one of the
hydrogenation process with nickel.
Yeah, which was one of the first big research projects you worked on, as you were telling us this morning. And I was just wondering if the two of you consciously looked for research projects with the laboratories that capitalized on the experience that you had in those particular techniques.
Well, in some cases, yeah. Well, we had that background and knowledge. And applied it to another problem, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the knowledge was the important thing. Just what the product was immaterial, you might say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this cut down, you know, lacquer in those days would wrinkle, you might say. That's what it did, and orange peel, we called it.
Yeah. So that would make, using this process would cut down on the sanding time and all the, you know, would just...
And a better looking job.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one other question that I wanted to ask about the decade that you were an independent consulting lab was, how did you figure out how to charge clients, and you know what a lot of it must have just been learning by doing, I suppose. But
well, that's right. But we did it by putting that number of men that would be required,
mm-hmm.
and then added a certain percentage on that.
Yeah.
So salaries and overhead on those men plus the profit there.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten what the figures were we used, but that's true. Well, for instance, what did the Monsanto contract amount to? I don't know whether it was 25,000 or 30,000 or what, or 40,
yeah.
depending on the number of men that was on the job, you see.
Yeah.
But that's basically the way we did it, with our salary plus the overhead on it,
mm-hmm.
plus the profit.
We might as well move back to Monsanto then, unless you think there's anything else that's important about to get on the tape about.
That might, I can understand it.
We might as well move back to Monsanto unless you think there's anything else that we should get on the tape about Thomas and Hochwald before 1936.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if we cover the main points in those days. I'll never forget the day when we had the big fire at the laboratory, and we were out of business. But
oh, tell me about that. But
I don't know. We were working on hydrocarbon cracking, and a fire developed and spread. But it did not ruin the building. It was just a matter of picking up the debris and starting over again.
Mm.
But it was pretty bad at one time because it was the gasoline fire.
Mm, yeah.
And but we saved the building and saved most of the laboratory, so we carried right on, and that's when we put on the addition
mm-hmm.
to the laboratory. We decided we needed more space for it. So it didn't hold us up too long, but it was there.
What year was that in?
1928, I think it was. Mm-hmm. That fit? Yeah, 1928. Mm-hmm. That was the year.
Well, this morning you mentioned that there were about 80 to 85 people at Thomas and Hochwald when Monsanto
took us over.
Were there any immediate changes in the number of staff that you had? Did you expand rapidly at that point once you became
part of the company? Yeah, we had an expansion in physical facilities, more laboratories, dining room and all that sort of business. Air conditioning, which we hadn't had before.
Mm-hmm.
And we put on more men, yes. I don't know what the increase was, say, over a year or two, but it was appreciable.
Mm-hmm.
Must have been 12 or 15% anyway, more manpower.
Yeah.
But we were very careful of the men we picked. I mean, as I say, 80% of them had their PhDs,
mm-hmm.
good schools, good men that were interested in research, per se, the advancement of knowledge. And we had men who really had a purpose in life.
Because yeah. You were telling us at lunch about some of the schools that they came from. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about where you recruited new PhDs for the staff.
Well, we recruited from Penn State, and that was through, what was the professor there? He's a good friend of ours. Well, I kind of looked down here now.
Well, anyway, Penn State, Harvard, MIT.
Was it Feeser you would recruit students? Did you recruit from Feeser?
Yeah, we recruited from him at Harvard, you mean. Wasn't it Harvard?
That's
or Feeser. Conant, we recruited from him. And also Illinois, what was his name? He died just a few months ago. Famous. He used to be the DuPont consultant. That was his name. Well known.
Well, Adams or Marvel?
Adams. Well, yes, Speed Marvel was another one. And, you know, Speed, his son is working for Monsanto. He's the head of the agricultural research.
Did Marvel ever consult for Monsanto the way that he did for DuPont?
No. I think he did for DuPont, but no, Monsanto didn't employ consultants. I mean, university consultants anyway. We used to have, in my day in Monsanto, we did put Kistiakowski on. Remember that name?
Oh, sure. Yeah, what did he do for you?
Well, not much, but he particularly got him for physical chemical reasons. I can't recall just where he was helpful, but
when would that have been? In the 50s? In the 50s, or?
That was in the 50s, yeah. Roger Adams is the one I was thinking of, and he mentioned that to Illinois, right? And we used to go to the University of Chicago, University of Dayton, University of Cincinnati. But most of our men, I would say, were from Eastern colleges. Although we had some from Michigan, too, in fact.
Aside from Dayton, where you said you did get a lot of people from, especially early on, was there any other school that had the same kind of special relationship with Monsanto research that Illinois had with DuPont?
No, they didn't have any particular one, at least. As I say, we didn't use university consultants very much in Monsanto. Outside of Kistiakowski, and he's right now the only one I can remember. Oh, Speed Marvel, no, he was not a consultant. They used to get men from Speed. I don't believe so. I mean, Monsanto just didn't do that. I think we had a better appreciation of that than they did, you see, of the value those fellows could be. See, Monsanto, when we came in, Monsanto's main laboratory was the laboratory of the organic division, which is located in St. Louis. And a fellow by the name of Tarides was the head of it. He was a Greek. And I don't know where he studied, where he got his degree. But he was not as broad-minded as he should be as a director of research and as interested in outside things. And he was more in bettering the products Monsanto had, you see, rather than in coming out with new products. And when Edward took us over, not only to better the scientific reputation of Monsanto. Pardon? Okay, Robbie, thanks a lot. He got where he wanted to go.
Right there.
Okay. Where was I?
You were saying that Queenie not only wanted to better the Monsanto's products, but...
I lost my thought on that. Ambitious to explore expand and abolish Monsanto and increase its basic products, I mean the chemicals, and get into all fields where we could play a part. Whereas trees is more in developing, maybe this developing better methods of making them and extensions of them, say if you were in commercial solvents, where you might add one or two more, you see, or something mm-hmm. like that.
But not up
in staying in the same field. That sounds, I don't know whether I want to put that in there, though. That sounds like I'm criticizing the reason.
You could only...
He left Monsanto years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, he was unhappy when they bought Thomas and Hopwell out.
Well, and as you started to tell us this morning, you and your colleagues soon began to go into all sorts of new areas.
That's what?
You and your colleagues soon began to go into all sorts of new areas, like...
Well, we were interested in getting Monsanto into petrochemicals, detergents, fibers, but petrochemicals was a very important factor in there, and that's what we got at the Monsanto. Both of Charlie and I had experience in that area. Petrochemicals, and that season came up with styrene, and so that we expanded, you might say, the whole scope of Monsanto activities.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the work you did for Rubber Reserve in World War II?
For who?
The Rubber Reserve.
Well, we simply produced, we started in the styrene when Rubber Reserve was starting it. We had the pilot plant in Dayton, and that was to be one of the sources of their styrene for their rubber, for their GRS.
Did you have connection with the rubber research discussion group in Akron at all, or was just...
No, but we were a producer, became a producer,
mm-hmm.
right at the time they were ready to start our styrene plant. As a matter of fact, I think we beat Delta
mm-hmm.
in the production of styrene.
Mm-hmm.
But we were a supplier to Rubber Reserve.
And what uses did you put the styrene to right after the war?
Plastics.
Mm-hmm. Could you just talk a little bit about the development of that?
General plastics, yeah, and then combining them with other olefinic and dyeing products to make combinations of mm-hmm. styrene, butadiene, acrylonitrile, and so on, and mm-hmm. making a composite polymer.
Mm-hmm.
Three unit polymer, and they're still in that business, and that's mm-hmm. one of the big businesses of Monsanto, the whole polymer end of it. And the styrene was, was a glass-like clear hydrocarbon plastic that was very effective and still being used to a great extent.
Mm.
For various objects.
And a few years after that, the laboratories began work on acrylonitrile and fibers from acrylonitrile. Well, and a theme that runs through a lot of the chemistry in that period from about 1940 to 1955 is its relation to acrylonitrile.
No, our fiber was based on that, you see.
And
we thought if we made the fiber, we ought to also make the mm-hmm. monomer, the acrylonitrile,
mm-hmm.
which we did simultaneously with the development of the fiber
mm-hmm.
from the acrylonitrile.
What did the market opportunities look like then? The market opportunities. Earlier today, you were telling us about how you and Charles Thomas would look. We're always sort of looking ahead in the 20s for new opportunities for the laboratories to get into. And I just wondered what your perception was of the opportunities after the war in those areas.
Well, what we saw was that the country needed synthetic fibers. It was because cotton prices were going up,
mm-hmm.
rayon was going up in price, and it was thought that people who liked like the clothing industry, I mean, and they, that they would need additional available choices, you see. And that, and DuPont proved that with nylon, and we were out to prove it for acrylic, which we did. Now that's a wool-like fiber, and that replaces wool to a great extent. And a lot of uses, that's for suitings and, well, anything, draperies, furniture, upholstery. I had a little story I had on that, and yeah, I thought, well, I can't find the damn thing that I want.
We had a library, and he died of about 3,500 books. And he was a self-taught person, as a matter of fact. And as I say, he developed this particular hobby, which became a business with him. And, but then he also wrote some fiction, too. Two or three books, Arrows of Ambition and a couple of others.
These were under his own name.
This is on other subjects. I mean, it was about the 30-year war in Europe and so on. Was it 30 years?
There was a 30-year war.
Yeah, and but he was a very able person and a very intellectual person. He was interested in history, literature, art. And then we would also judge these field trials and judge the bench shows, dog bench shows, you know, the best dog in the area. And he'd go over to England quite often to judge shows over there, France, but always fighting and so on. So he was a very, very able person. I, even if he was my father, it sounds boastful, but I, that is a fact. But he didn't go through college, but he better off without it, I think, in this case.
Was he himself a native of Dayton, or?
He's a native of Dayton, yes. My ancestors came over, as I understand, around from Germany in about 1890. Went to Baltimore and then to Ohio and then settled in Dayton. Grandfather Hopkoff, and they were all born, I mean, my grandparents were born in this country.
And your mother?
My mother, the same. I mean, she was born in Dayton, her family. Originally came from Germany. I'm not too certain when that was. But her grandparents, I mean, her parents were born in this country, too.
Were you the oldest of the children? Or
I was the youngest.
You were.
Of the four. My brothers are, my oldest brother died early. I mean, he was about 21 during the flu epidemic back in the World War. I mean, before that, at the time of the First World War. And my second brother was a businessman. He was in. My third brother was an MD in Dayton. Very, well, I guess it's principally for a baby doctor. What do you call him?
Pediatrician.
Obstetrician.
Obstetrician. And myself.
Were you outrageously spoiled as the youngest, or what?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. No, at least I don't think. But then, going into my field, we went to school, all of us went to the University of Dayton. At that time it was called St. Mary's Institute. But they also ran a high school. And I went to that high school, St. Mary's Institute, as my brother did. And I went to college, it became the University of Dayton. And I took all my college work there, and my other brothers did too, except my oldest brother who had died. But it was while I was in that high school, they'd take us around to the college end of the school. And one day they took us through the laboratory, and I saw an apparatus, glass,
glowing, beautiful glass going glass, an apparatus to perform some experiments, and I was so interested in it, I said, that's the field I want to get into. And so I decided to take up chemistry, chemical engineering. When I graduated from high school, and then the college section of the University of Dayton, I was fortunate, the school was fortunate in having a professor there who was an inspirational, outstanding man, inspirational teacher, one who could imbue his students with the love of the subject. His name was Warhaven. He got his degree over at the University of Fribourg, Switzerland. And this was run by, we call it the Brothers of Mary. It's really a religious order. It's a Catholic school, you see. And he graduated at Fribourg after he had joined this order. But they sent him over there to take up chemistry, you see. So he eventually became professor of chemistry, organic chemistry, at the University of Dayton. And I owe a lot of what I may have to him. He is an outstanding man. And he helped us even start our laboratory, Charlie and I. We asked his advice on things, and before we had our laboratory equipped, he turned one of the laboratories over to us for our work and on this fire extinguisher.
On the labs in the college?
In the college. And we worked and really developed that fire extinguisher at the University of Dayton Laboratory, which he had turned over to us just to utilize and the equipment and so on. And because we didn't, our own laboratory was not completed yet. We had the site in that same building that you saw there after Big Metal Products moved out. General Motors first came in, and they moved to Marine City. But we used this laboratory on the third floor of this building, and really established it and equipped it, and that's where General Motors helped us out. Then in another year or two, we outgrew that, and we had our laboratory on Nicholas Road in Dayton, Ohio. That's the buildings that you see in one of those pictures there. We bought that land and took over the laboratory and worked, and we really went into our own consulting work.
Let me take you back, if I may, into... This is absolutely fine. Into high school and college. The professor's name was...
The what?
The professor's name...
Warhaven, Wohlleben. Live well.
And it was when you had moved into the college that you met him, or was that already in your high school experience?
No, that was after I moved into the college. We didn't have him in high school. No, I only got to know him, but they did allow the high school students to, maybe selling them a lot. I took them to various physics lab and the chemical lab and so on. And that's where I decided that was the field I wanted to enter.
And before that, you said one of your older brothers had become a doctor, and your father had a large library. I was just curious to know whether his library included science books that you might have encountered when you were younger.
No, it did not.
Okay. And had your brothers medical...
Uh, same way.
Mm-hmm.
Medical, but his was principally, well, literature and art, all sorts, and well, I have many of the books here now at the house. I mean, some of them, but he was my father was a typical self-made man. I mean that. And when you're number one in your field, you can't get any better than that. And he was. He was that one. He died as an incredibly young man, 68. But my mother lived because she was 22.
How old were you yourself when your father died?
I was 38, I was 39.
So that, let me just make sure I'm understanding your awareness of and fascination with science really didn't come until you were into the college, beginning college days.
Well, that's when I decided to go to college, you see. My interest was, you might say, when I went through this laboratory, which is in my last year in high school. And then the following semester, I went into college.
There was never really any question but that you would stay in Dayton, and your brothers had gone to St. Mary's Institute as well, had they? Was that become the family tradition?
No. And, no, I lived at Dayton then until I was going to Heatherville until 1949. When Monsanto asked me to move over here. So I was in Dayton all that whole period. And my family is still there. Those are the boys in Dayton. So my roots are really there, not here.
Had you ever considered going into, say, aeronautical engineering instead of chemical engineering, given that Dayton was such an important center for that?
Chemistry is my field.
Yeah. I just, most people...
I knew that right away. I don't know why. There's something about it. That, and I think Wohlleben is the probably the reason for it.
What sort of things were you learning in formal courses in chemistry with Professor Wohlleben and others at that time?
Well, physical chem, organic.
Do you recall any of the textbooks that impressed you at the time, or any of the other things you were reading?
No. I got it downstairs. With, yeah, I'll give you. I really get it. Can you bring up an interesting point?
Sure.
The smoking bag?
No, not at all. Solomon Walker.
That looks very interesting. So,
you got the tape back on?
Yes. Yes. I turned the tape off while you were downstairs. I just put it back on. Well, that's it's intriguing that you still have your first organic chem text. What was the course like at that time? Was it mainly preparations? Was it?
It was a lot of theory, and of course laboratory work. I mean, and I also had the advantage when I was in sophomore year, Wohlleben asked me to give an organic course to the pre-medics of the school, which I did for a couple of years.
That was pretty unusual.
While I was a student, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I knew chemistry. Also, I had the advantage. I joined Kelling's laboratory. The laboratory of the great metal products. In my, as I said, the sophomore year, when
graduate school in junior year, so I had that experience in that laboratory also in addition.
How did you get in there? What?
Well, that was during the war, of course. And it so happened that one of my friend's classmates told me about it. He said that he had found out about it and there was a position open for a laboratory assistant. But he didn't decide not to do it because he went to over to the war companies, you see, that were also in Dayton. Because he could make more money there. But he's the one that told me about this position at this laboratory, and I went there immediately. And they gave it to me. And of course, I was the luckiest guy in the world. I mean, to have that background, working with cuttering and visually, and having all that experience, because I used to, even though I was only a sophomore at that time, I knew a little chemistry too, and I was helping. I worked on the pilot plants, which we'll go into it later. But I was in the laboratory with Boyd and helping synthesize different things. In those days, you know, it wasn't so easy in the laboratory because these ordinary reagents that you needed were not available. I mean, you couldn't buy them from Eastman, you know, and Kallbaum and all those people. You got them, you had to make them yourself. And I got a terrific amount of experience as a result of that work with while I was still in school.
You'd really decided at a very early stage here that that organic chemistry was the...
Organic is my field.
Yes.
Yeah. I took chemical engineering, of course, but organic was a very important part of that. But my degree is in Bachelor of Chemical Engineering. Then I later, that's another story. I did some work on this fire extinguisher, because that was an outstanding discovery, finding these alkaline metals. It had a sort of catalytic effect on flame. And the University of Dayton gave me even though it was after I graduated, gave me a PhD on that basis. I turned sort of a thesis into them, you see. But this was after I graduated.
What, you must have been extraordinarily busy if already by your sophomore year you were going to Dayton Metal Products. Was that in the daytime or in the evening?
That was a full-time in the summers. That was a full-time job.
And then you were...
But whenever we'd have a day or two free, for some reason or other at the university, I would go to the laboratory. They wanted me any time I was available, in other words. Misery did, and Kevin.
Could you tell us a little bit about Dayton Metal Products at that time when you joined them, and what the facilities were like, what kind of atmosphere was to work in?
Their laboratory, of course, their plant, I don't know what the heck they made, as a matter of fact, some war materials, but they had this laboratory, which was really a plaything of cats, of catting. And they were working on... various things, but lead tetraethyl, I mean, the anti-knock was the principal thing which they started. So my experience with them, when I was with them, was with anti-knock materials. I mean, the making of them, I synthesized them, developed the methods. I was pretty handy in setting up equipment. Zinc ethyl is a bad compound. I don't know whether you know it or not. You don't handle it right, it takes fire as soon as air gets it. You had to be a little active on that.
Were there standard methods for dealing with that, or did you have to develop ways of handling zinc ethyl?
We had to develop. Well, the making of it was standard, of course, but in the handling of it, using it as an alkylating agent to make organometallic compounds, you see, like lead tetraethyl, tin ethyl, and antimony, the whole slew of them.
So you really got in on the ground floor at Dayton Metal Products.
During my summers while I was at school, yeah. At the university.
Yeah.
See, even at Christmas vacation, I'd go down there and work for 4 or 5 days or a week or something.
Yeah.
So, see, also at that laboratory in Dayton Metal Products, that was during the war, and this matter of knock became quite knock in the pre-ignition in the engine became of great importance, because gasolines in those days, when nothing is known about it, they either knocked or they didn't knock. Most of them knocked, and the airplanes of those days, like that, they knocked so badly it would even break the pistons. So Midgley, I guess Midgley is the one that started it. We found out that cyclohexane, which is a hydrogenated benzene, understand cyclohexane?
Yeah.
And benzene, of course, doesn't knock either. But nevertheless, when you converted it to cyclohexane by hydrogenation of benzene, the octane value of it was even higher. And we developed a process for making cyclohexane for the Air Corps at this laboratory. I mean, we made 50 gallons or 100 gallons in a pilot plant, and I operated the pilot plant. I ran that. But those are the early days, and it was not in any quantity, and that's the reason, even though chemically, it was right, I mean, it had the right molecular structure, the hydrocarbons did, so that they didn't knock. Nevertheless, that wasn't the solution to the main problem of a knocking motor. I mean, the thought was to add something smaller volume than that, mm-hmm. and not use it as a fuel itself, you see.
Yeah.
And that's the reason they got into the anti-knock then.
How big was the lab in terms of Dayton Metal Products, in terms of the number of people who were there?
Well, the laboratory as a whole, not too many. I don't think there were more than 24 of us. But they also had a machine shop, and they had a lot of people there. Machine shop in connection with the, because they were trying to make a plan with various types of engines and all that sort of thing. But so far as laboratory people were concerned, I'd say there weren't more than a couple of dozen of us.
Mm-hmm.
And in this fuel section, it was only Midgley and Boyd and myself in those days, with one or two helpers. And when we had the cyclohexane pilot plant, we had two or three more helpers in those days. See, we made that by hydrogenating benzene over a nickel catalyst in the presence of hydrogen. And that converted the benzene into cyclohexane.
What kind of problems did you face when you had to scale up the laboratory process, or, you know, to make the pilot plant to produce larger quantities? Was that, I'm just thinking that wasn't the sort of thing that one would learn out of Holloman's textbook.
Oh, hell no. Well, we had to take a gas like benzene, gasify it. We knew we had to put a catalyst with it. So what we did, we took, we did this in an 8-foot tube, heated pipe, filled it with catalyst, and the catalyst was pumice, impregnated with nickel,
and passed vapors of benzene over it. So it wasn't much of a job.
Mm.
And that converted it to cyclohexane.
Where would you... I'm just curious where you found out about the properties of catalysts and how you chose that catalyst in particular. You know, where would, did you go to the patent literature? Did you just read the literature?
Well, we just knew that the nickel was a catalyst. And, any hydrogenation, I mean, most of them use nickel. Mm-hmm. Some of them platinum, plating, and so on. But in this case, nickel is quite satisfactory.
In the defining what was going on in some strategic way, was Charles Kettering very much the central force? So
well, yes, he was an inspirational fellow. He was questioning everything. He always better ways of doing things. And Kett had already had the experience of developing the automobile starter, the car starter. But of course, he didn't have any chemists around him in those days.